This episode contains graphic descriptions of real medical scenarios faced by real medical professionals. Listener discretion is advised. From Knowledgeable Provider, this is Critical Incident. Hello, welcome back to Critical Incident from Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. Recently, I had the opportunity to sit down with Michael David Smith, who is the former director of the Emergency Management Agency in Colbert County, Alabama. We talked a lot about what emergency management is and his role in that over his career, and I'm looking forward to bringing you that conversation in a future episode. One specific event we talked about is one that was probably one of the most critical incidents that we've had in this area as far as just affecting the EMS and public safety community. Back in 2007, a medical helicopter crashed over in Colbert County, AirEvac 16, and Michael David was actually directly involved in that incident that the helicopter was responding to, and subsequently in the recovery of the helicopter. And I asked him to talk a little bit more about that. I was hesitant to ask just because I knew it was close to home for him, but he graciously agreed to talk. So here's what he had to say about that, and we'll look forward to hearing more from him very soon.
So we had been dispatched to a missing person in the woods the night before and had been out there for several hours searching for a missing hunter, somebody who had went hunting and did not come back home at the appropriate time. And so family went out and found his vehicle was still in the place where he had parked it, and so knew he was still out there somewhere. AirEvac 16 had not been in the shoals very long at that point, just a few years, and so we still used them pretty regularly when we had some type of search situation because, you know, from that far up in the sky, you can cover a lot of ground pretty quick. And so they had been out with us for a while and had been making some rounds. They were going to go back to the base and fuel up, and we were going to kind of all come back in and regroup and see what we needed to do going forward, and because we hadn't had much luck that night. And so once they were getting out, they were going to check back in with us, see if they needed to come back. Well, once they got out of the area, and while they're flying around making their loops, you know, you start hearing that rotor wash so much that it just becomes part of the background noise, and you really don't know what other noises you're missing because that noise is going on. So once they got out of the area and we no longer had that rotor noise in the air, we heard a gunshot. And so we let them know, hey, we just heard a gunshot from this particular area. We feel like maybe this guy's trying to get our attention. And so they turned around and came back. And within just minutes of going to that area, they located him. We had all kind of regrouped back at the command post, and so everybody was kind of still up in that one area. And so we started sending crews down toward where they were hovering over him, trying to shine their spotlight on him. He was right off the edge of a bluff. He was okay. He wasn't hurt or anything, but just he was in a place where he was lost, and he was just kind of sitting still, and he wasn't going to try to make it any worse. And so they were hovering. We started having folks go down the bluff toward where he was at. And the next thing we know, we were talking with them on the radio. Bragwell was kind of giving us a visual or trying to describe, paint that picture for us as to based on what side of the helicopter they were looking out of, where he was at, and how we could best get down there to him. And so they were sitting there hovering. And again, that rotor wash sound is in the air. And, you know, it's just that one of those moments where we're focused on the mission. And, you know, the next thing we know, there's just this bang, 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 and plop. And it was just that quick. It was over with. And so quickly the mission changed. Half of the crews that were headed down to try to retrieve that missing hunter continued on to him, and half of them split off to go to where the crash had happened at. When it hit the ground, you know, there was a lot of people that described it as an explosion. It really wasn't an explosion. It was more of a fuel had leaked out, and then there was a spark in the fuel. You know how it's not gasoline, of course, but you know how if you throw a match in gasoline, how it kind of, you know, well, that's basically what it was. And so pretty quickly, the aircraft was fully involved, and the terrain that it was in down there was impossible to get any type of firefighting apparatus down to. So we called forestry in, and they had came with a dozer and helped cut a line down to where we could get some type of firefighting equipment down there to be able to try to extinguish the fire. And now it wasn't just a quick response, but it was going to be a long-term recovery because we had to wait on NTSB to come in, and we had to have all those investigations take place before any of the pieces could. So what turned into something that could have been over within just a few hours now turned into a week response because of all of a sudden, all the resources that were coming to the scene. But, you know, that was something that really changed a lot of people's lives. We had a lot of friends that worked for AirEvac or other air services that really had to reflect on, did they want to go back to work and do that anymore? And so some of them didn't. You know, some of them continued to go and still do today. And I really appreciate them for that. But some had to make the decision that they didn't want to take that chance anymore. And so, you know, it's something that will always be in your mind. I still don't like being around a helicopter. If one's coming in, it's not really a flashback, so to speak, but you just kind of get that uneasy feeling when one's landing or taking off of what might happen. And so I always just have to kind of walk around behind a vehicle or just turn and look away and wait for it to be over with is the best way to put it. But it is definitely something that changed our lives. We lost three great people that we'd worked with for a long time. And that really made it closer to home too. If it'd been not to downplay this any at all, but if it had been a crew or a situation where it was somebody from a company that we really weren't familiar with and hadn't worked with very regularly and didn't know the people, it would have been one thing. It still would have been a traumatic incident and it still would have been very bad, but just by the fact that we knew these people and we spent Christmases with these people and we knew their families and knew them personally just really hit home with a lot of folks and changed everybody's lives forever. And they're still touching lives, you know, however many years now it is later, you still hear people telling Alan Bragwell stories and the things that he did and the way that he treated people. And it's just this legacy that lives on, you know, you just keep referring back to it. And it's just amazing. And I hope that when I do go on from this world, that I've touched somebody in some way that will continue to happen too. I don't necessarily need stories told about me, but just being nice to people and just, you know, helping people just get through some worst moment in their life so that they can carry on to the next day. That's all I hope for. And that's something that he did and that whole crew did really. And so it really changed us. A lot of things came out of that changed the way that response is made. You know, AirEvac doesn't necessarily do search and rescues anymore. So they have a lot more safety factors in place now than ever. And that's not only based on that one incident, but other incidents that's happened in air response over the years. But everything that happens results in a policy change of some sort, and so that it doesn't happen again. And so it changed a lot of things for a lot of people that night.
Thank you for sharing all that. I know you're closer to it than a lot of people as far as the incident itself. And yeah, Alan, like, I didn't know Mike Baker, the pilot at all. Tiffany, I had some interaction with her just doing my medic training and coming in and out of the ER, and she was, I know she was fantastic. Sometimes I feel bad about focusing on Alan just because I don't want to act like the other two weren't important.
Exactly.
But I also don't want to act like Alan Bragwell is my best friend.
Sure.
But just being in the EMS community around here, he was just such a big deal. And even me, somebody who's was not particularly close to him, like, it was devastating to me, you know? He was just such, I don't even know how you describe his role, but like the whole EMS community around here, like, he was just at the top. Everybody wanted to be like him. He had such an impact on everybody. God. And you cannot be around him and not be in a good mood.
Absolutely. It don't matter what's going on in your life when Alan's around. You were going to laugh about something. You were going to be in a good mood. He was going to make it better, for sure. There's a story that Rena tells sometimes. You may have been on the call with her. The rescue squad had went out on a call where a tree had fell on somebody down off of Coondog Cemetery Road. So Bragwell was there on Keller's ambulance, and AirEvac was coming in. And as they were coming in for landing, he turned around and mooned them as they were coming. So she came in telling me about that, and I was like, yeah, that is typically Alan Bragwell right there.
No, I think I would remember that. I don't think I was on that call.
But yeah, I agree. That story, when I tell that story, it always ends up going into something about Alan. And I hate that for the other two because I don't want it to seem like they were any less.
Right, of course.
But he was such a huge part of the community and right here, you know, a Cherokee boy right here from Cherokee, Alabama. And so many people just thought so much of him.
I know it still felt, for sure. Even I was at Northwest Shoals yesterday, and there's one of those big AirEvac 16 in memory of stickers right on the door of the EMS classroom.
This past year, the Volunteer Fire Association developed a Hall of Fame ceremony where they start incorporating folks from the Volunteer Fire Service over the years into their Hall of Fame.
Oh, sweet.
And so Alan Bragwell was actually one of the first inductees in the first class this year, and his dad and kids and all the family got to come and be a part of that. And it was awesome to be able to recognize him and to just, again, continue that legacy on for somebody else. You know, so many people from here on out will just be a better person just because of something that he did.
Yeah, for sure. Not to mention all the lives he's directly saved,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
Gosh.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, what an impact. That was another thing about him, too, is he was a professional, you know, full-time paramedic, but then he also volunteered. Actually, I probably ran more calls with him as a volunteer out in Underwood, Petersville?
Yes.
Maybe?
Yes.
Out in that area. And man, I love, gosh, what a responder to show up on the scene.
Yes.
I was always like,
yes. When you heard somebody on the radio like that going to a scene, responding as for the fire department, you're like, okay, it's going to be okay when I get there.
That's right. That's right. And maybe I should try to paint the picture too of like, this is a juvenile thing to say, I guess, but I was a juvenile when I was in high school. Like the paramedics, the paid paramedics for me, just as a volunteer kid, they were celebrities.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Really, that's how I thought of them.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, here comes Alan Bragwell. And,
right.
You know, Sheila Coates and
yes,
who's
yes.
Sherry Mabe. Like, they really were in my little world, in my little brain. Those were like,
yes.
You know, you're excited.
That yes.
You know, you kind of get nervous when they're going to show up.
That's right.
Oh, I got to go do a good job. Alan's coming.
Yes. Yes. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, that was great. Thank you for sharing all that.
Yes, definitely. I'm glad we could talk about it.
I was hesitant about asking you to talk about that, but I'm glad I did.
I didn't sleep much, you know, for a while after it happened, because every time I close my eyes, I just hear that, or the blades hitting hitting the tail or whatever it was. It was just that, and then it was,
it was it.
But I've moved on from that now. So the biggest thing now is I'll get on an airplane all day, every day. I'm not really worried about the flight part, but watching one take off or come in for landing. I just cannot get over that. And so I had to just turn away.
Yeah.
And if I could put a vehicle between myself and it, I do that too. You know?
Yeah, sure. I can. So. Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah. And maybe I should explain, and you can tell me if I'm incorrect in any of this, but my understanding is that what happened was loss of tail rotor effectiveness.
Yep.
And so it's not that the pilot did anything wrong. It just sometimes the tail rotor loses effectiveness. And if you're high enough in the air, you can correct for it.
That's right.
But because they were so low, he just didn't have time.
He did not have time. Bruce Carson kind of explained that to me not long after they kind of came out with those findings. And he really made it elementary for me to be able to understand what that really meant. And basically, that's right. It's something that can be corrected from if you're high enough in the air and you have enough room to make the correction. But they were so low right at treetop level that there just wasn't time to correct anything.
Sure.
It was over before it even started.
And then I think another element, right, was as you're pulling up to try to correct, it flexed the blade so much that the blade actually cut the tail boom off, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
We actually found that several yards closer to where our crews were coming down the mountain. Didn't know at the time, but, you know, some of those crews were very close to where that thing landed and didn't even realize it. Just so many things that could have been even worse that night.
Yeah, they didn't have a patient. They didn't land on anybody else. Yeah. The one time I've been out to the crash site, that was kind of the one thing that struck me, is there's a marker for each crew member. And it struck me what a blessing it was that there was not a fourth marker there for the patient.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true. Very much.